This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, sponsored by SoundRing. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
Welcome to Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Shane Told, and thank you for joining us for now the fourth installment of the new podcast. Today, I sit down with Stephen Christian, formerly of Amberlin, and we have a great conversation. I've known Stephen actually for quite a while, since 2003. I talk about a little bit in the interview. We were playing this festival, Furnace Fest, down in Alabama, and it was kind of, for Silverstein, it was the first big festival we'd ever played, and Hum was playing, and Taking Back Sunday, and Andrew WK, and it was this huge thing. And what I remember most about it is they had all the merch tables under this, it was like a highway overpass kind of thing, as I recall, and they had all the tables under there, and it started raining, and the overpass leaked all this water, and everyone's stuff got soaked except ours. We felt like the boat in Forrest Gump, the last boat standing, and everyone was coming over trying to get dry merch from us, and I remember we had a very good merch day. That's when I first met Stephen Christian from Amberlin, and we've been, you know, in and out of touch ever since, but it was really great to catch up, and this interview was just so eye-opening about what they went through as a band, what he went through personally, and his personality is just so interesting. And he talks about being introverted, and he talks about all this. It's just really fascinating interview, and probably my favorite one I've done so far. Once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and all the feedback has been so cool. I love people actually using the hate line now. I like this. 657-666-HATE. Give me a call, leave a message. I'm sure we'll do an all hate line episode at some point. So if you want to get on there, please give me a ring. And if you like the show, if you got ideas for guests, whatever you got, please just hit me up, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. Now, I got to talk about soundrink.com. They're sponsoring the show, and I love talking about them because they do all the VIP ticketing for Silverstein. And right now we're out with Census Fail. It's a great tour. We're just coming up Florida now. We're going to be coming up the East Coast. So it's going to be a prime time. I mean, it's going to be some of the great shows. So please go to soundrink.com. Check out the VIP packages. There's regular ticket links if you know, don't want to meet us in Census Fail. But if you do, there's some great merch items, all that stuff. We also have Stay Warm Festival coming up in Toronto, which is going to be awesome. That's on SoundRink. And we have just announced a Canadian tour also. So just pretty much just go to soundrink.com. It's got all your bases covered, whole bunch of other tours in your area coming up. So check that out as well. And before we jump into it with Stephen, there's one more thing I got to tell you about. Kings Road Merch is sponsoring this episode, and they actually run the official merch store for a band we actually talk about in the interview. They're called The Descendants. And if you don't know who The Descendants are, you probably should get on that. They're one of the most legendary punk rock bands. I mean, they're pretty much responsible for pop punk even existing. And right now, if you go to Kings Road Merch, they're running an awesome holiday sale for The Descendants, where you can get everything from t-shirts to hoodies. They have a holiday sweater up there. So right now, if you go there and order both holiday sweaters, you can get 10% off your entire order. Also, they've released a video called Filmage, which is basically the documentary of their career, The Descendants, and all. And you can check that as well. There's a new Blu-ray DVD out. It's got bonus content, all this stuff. So go there, check out kingsroadmerch.com/DESC. That's kingsroadmerch.com/DESC. And check out all that stuff from The Descendants. Awesome band, one of my favorite bands of all time. All right, let's get to it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Stephen Christian, formerly of Amberlin. Welcome to Lead Singer Syndrome. I'm here with my very, very old friend, Stephen Christian, formerly of Anne Berlin. How are you doing today, man?
Very good. Very good. I'm here in Corrales, New Mexico, and winter is setting in, and I'm enjoying every second of it. It's a nice change.
Well, you're a Florida dude, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, originally.
So how do you like the winters?
You know, I like it a lot because it's way, you know, it's different than what, you know, than what I grew up with. So I enjoy it in that aspect. You know, I mean, obviously, like, here in New Mexico, I live in the desert. So that's awesome, you know. And then there's mountains. I think that's the big kicker, is the fact that there's mountains.
Oh,
and that's something obviously.
I love mountains.
Yeah, we just never had that.
I live in Toronto. And, you know, Canada, I'm sure, you know, you've been across Canada many times with your band and your projects. But
yes.
The part of Canada we live, we don't have any mountains. It's very flat.
Oh,
so whenever
wow.
I'm traveling, like, yeah, like in New Mexico or like anywhere on the West Coast.
Right.
I'm always like, man, it's so beautiful. And like, I would just love to wake up every day and see a mountain. And I think people that live out there really do take it for granted.
I agree, you know, because I'm still mesmerized by it.
Oh, that's amazing. So obviously you've experienced cold weather before, touring with Anne Berlin, you know, for so many years, but that must have been pretty weird initially when you left Florida and, you know, you're like stuck in Michigan or something and it's like minus 20. How was that for you?
Yeah, that's crazy. I think the worst kind of shock of my life was Winnipeg in January. It was negative 15 and I just couldn't fathom how people still live in Winnipeg. You know, like maybe they're just used to it. They're born into it or something. But I was.
I don't know. I mean, Winnipeg is like way colder than Toronto, you know. We'll have like, it'll get down to minus 20 here for, you know, like a couple weeks, maybe a year.
Right.
And I mean, I'm not a winter dude. Like I can't handle it. I don't know why, you know, I'm used to it obviously,
yeah.
But like, every time I'm anywhere, you know, in those like southern United States, I'm like, man, this is like a dream, you know, like the amount of time I've spent in my life shoveling driveways, you know, when I could be like reading books and learning.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like a bit of a waste of time. It's like, why do we live here?
I agree. I agree. I mean, trust me, I love Canada. Vancouver's awesome. Toronto's awesome. There's some great places, but Kelowna, so I have some family in Kelowna, but I could never do it, man. You guys are much more like, obviously like more, I don't want to say barbaric, but more like husky. You gotta be a man of character to live in Canada, I think.
I think so.
You know,
yeah.
A little more gumption than the rest of us.
Maybe. So how did you end up in Albuquerque?
Wow.
You're just a big Breaking Bad fan?
Yeah,
or
Breaking Bad fan. So I was like, oh man, I want to sell meth. So I moved. No, it wasn't like that. It was, you know, I had explored a lot of different options in Nashville and just nothing felt right. So I had some friends out here that worked at a great church called Calvary, and they offered me an incredible position, and I just wanted to change, and I just wanted to, just try new things musically. And so for me, this was like absolutely out of the ordinary from Nashville. That's an understatement. So,
because you were in Nashville, you were working on like writing songs. You had like a
publishing
thing going on.
Yeah, and I'm still doing all that. I'm still writing and all that from here. It's just, you know, it's a little bit, you know, now that now I kind of am, it, you know, I call it the great hustle. Nashville is the great hustle for me, because like nobody there has just one job. You know, if you're a songwriter, you're probably working at Starbucks. If you're an artist, uh-huh. you're probably working at a bar. You know, like whatever the case might be, you know, you've got a second or third or even fourth job. So I just kind of wanted to take a little break from that, because my whole life had been a giant hustle. And in a positive, I mean, I don't mean that in a negative connotation. I love to hustle. I mean, I think it's in some people's DNA. It's just how they were built.
Yeah.
And so I loved it, but I kind of just wanted a little break. You know, I had been on the road, obviously, for, you know, at that point last year, we were on the road for like, you know, right over 8 months of that last year. And it was just kind of like, ah, man, I just want a little break. And for me, the desert kind of represented that kind of life. And so I was excited to try something new.
And when you finally, you know, obviously we're going to talk a lot about Anne Berlin and your career and all the amazing, you know, things that happened to you. There's so much interesting stuff to talk about. But I mean, right now where you stand, I mean, you guys were pretty much a full-time touring band, you know, at least 8 months of the year for like, what, 13 years or something?
Yeah, 12 years, yep.
12 years. So, I mean, when that all stopped and that came to kind of like a screeching halt, how difficult was that for you?
Not at all. I mean, I was literally exhausted. You know, there was, I mean, the last few weeks of the tour, to be brutally honest, I was ready to go home. I could have cared less if we would have done the other shows. The only thing that kept me going to the next show was knowing that if I didn't show up, if I somehow quit, which I would never have done, even just for the sake of the other guys in the band. But I knew that if I didn't give 100%, I was letting down fans, and they were always the driving force of the band for me. And so I knew, like, if I was just threw up my hands and said, forget it, guys, we have a month left, but I am exhausted, like, mentally, like, you know, my body was, like, shutting down. You know, I would sleep for, like, just 12 hours a day, but the mental fatigue and the physical fatigue of it all, you know, because I mean, man, our touring schedule was insane. I mean,
You guys went as hard as anyone.
Yeah,
did.
I mean, like the last few months were just crazy. The fact, like, we got done with a 2.5 month festival summer tour, and then from the last final date flew to Brazil, and from Brazil flew to Australia, then flew to the UK, then back to the United States then back to Europe, and then back to our final two months of our last tour, and so we were all just done. You know, I was baked. So honestly, getting off the road, which is a huge regret. You know, I always wanted to end the band, you know, kind of a month off, month on, month off, month on, month off, you know, kind of just touring every other month just to enjoy it. But, you know, some of the guys in the band or management or whatever, we just, you know, kind of ended up voting that the conclusive, that, you know, hey, this is going to be what's best. And, for the band as a democracy, I guess you could call it. But by the end, I was just ready. I could care less. You know, the only thing that was keeping me on that stage was that hour and a half where, you know, because I knew, I saw like the emotion, I saw the intensity, the energy, the commitment. You know, there wasn't a lot of people like where they had just been like, oh, who's Anne Berlin? I think I'll buy tickets to this random show. It was all people either following us around the country or had bought tickets like months and months in advance. Or, you know, these shows didn't just like sell out the night of the show. These were like sellouts months prior. So for me, it was like, I've got to give my all to these guys. You know, they have been, you know, they've been looking forward to this for months. You know, they have been, have been dwelling on this and writing us and emailing us and sending us letters and, tweeting us and, you know, getting on social media and, you know, showing such great support that they were the ones that kept me on there night after night.
I thought it was kind of weird that you guys chose to do Warped Tour kind of in your last year as a band.
Yeah.
Why did you make that decision?
Yeah, I did too. You know, I it wasn't like priority number one for me, but to my objective was, you know, if I had a favorite band, I would at least want to have the opportunity to see them one more time. And so for us, we thought to ourselves, what is the greatest amount of people that we can reach at any given point? Like, that was only our second, you know, people think, oh, Anne Berlin Warped Tour band, but that was literally only our second time ever playing Warped Tour. And so for us, it was kind of like we just wanted what was going to reach the greatest number of people so that we gave everybody an opportunity or a chance to see us one last time. And in addition, we felt like in some way we owed it to Tooth & Nail. Tooth & Nail decided like, hey, you know, we're going to be so passionate about you guys. We want to push you guys so much. Would you, you know, this last record, would you guys be willing to go on Warped Tour? And for us, Tooth & Nail had always been so good to us. We love Tooth & Nail. We have a great relationship with Tooth & Nail. And so we wanted to give the record record the best possible chance that it could and show Tooth & Nail that, you know, we were willing to work and we were going to work hard for them. And so when they suggested it, we kind of, you know, at first, obviously, your first inclination is to say no. But for us, we felt like, man, this would be awesome for fans, you know, for people who might never get a chance, you know, in some of these markets, because we weren't going to go back to a lot of these markets.
That makes sense.
And so,
yeah,
you know, we weren't going to like go to Albuquerque and then come back to Albuquerque. We were going to go, you know, this was it. This was the final for these,
yep.
you know, and some of these were B markets and we knew we weren't going to get a chance to hit those.
Right.
And so for us, we just wanted to do what was best for the greatest number of fans.
So that final show you guys played, where was
Orlando, Florida at the House of Blues.
Orlando House of Blues. Oh man. So, you know, you say when it's all wrapped up, you were done, you know, you were like, I mean, you were so burnt out over, you know, 12 years that you were done. Did feeling that way take away from that moment of your last show, or did it still end up being as emotional as, you know, as I would imagine it to be?
No, I mean, sadly, it did take away. It absolutely took away. You know, I wish we would have had more breaks or more time in there. Again, I really did want to tour differently our last year. But, you know, I understand that, you know, it's a band. It's six people making a decision. You know, it's not just one.
Well, the other thing too is I mean, it would be stupid. Well, not stupid. It would be, it wouldn't be right to not talk about money. I mean, obviously this has been your source of income with your other bandmates for more than a decade. You guys haven't had other jobs, I assume.
No, we did.
You know,
we did have other jobs.
You did have you have number one song on radio and you have other jobs. How pardon my language, how fucked up is that?
Yeah, you know.
But no, I just mean to ask you, like, obviously the promise of money and this kind of being your last payday that you're going to have as a band, that must have factored into what you chose to do too.
Not me personally. I would literally have gone back in time and take a massive pay cut if we could have done it differently, you know. And listen, let me state out two things. Number one, or a couple things, you know. Number one, I love the guys, and I understand why they chose what they did. You know, we were just in a different mental place at that time, and you know, I don't blame them. I don't say like I just wished it was different. I don't say that they were wrong or that they, you know, that I'm pissed or anything like that. It's not like that at all. It was very much like, you know, hey, I want whatever, you know, I want peace in the band and I want, you know, everybody to get along. I want us all to like leave out, you know, friends. And so I'm willing to do whatever everybody decides. It was, you know, they understood where I was at and I understood where they were at. So it wasn't like I was going to say, you know, I'm not going. I may said like, no, I don't want to do this particular tour or not, but you know, but there was no animosity at the end of the day. And also,
and you guys are still close? You guys still talk quite often?
Yeah, I talked to Christian and Nate and Joey and but let me go back to one more thing, like just really fast. It was as far as like I just want to make sure that people know that like even though we were burnt out, you know, and I want to speak for a few of the guys in the band, it wasn't, you know, just me. We always put like 100% into the show, you know, like night after night, you know. It wasn't like, you know,
no one would ever question that. I mean, I've seen your band play. I mean, I don't want to say maybe not dozens of times, but I mean, at least a dozen times. And I was always amazed with how much energy you guys had. I mean, even from when like 2003 all the way up to maybe the last time I saw you was, cause I didn't get a chance to see you last year, but maybe like in 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody would ever say, oh, they're phoning it in. That was never your style.
Yeah, no. And again, night after night, just being up there, just, I mean, that last tour. And I mean, that's another contributing factor. You know, you go up there and you play an hour and a half, 2 hours a night for that many months in a row. I don't, you know, I think anybody would be kind of, you know, I don't even think NFL seasons or NBA seasons are 8 months long, you know?
maybe hockey is, but, yeah. No, but I mean, all those years, you know, this is the Lead Singer Syndrome podcast. So, one thing that lead singers like to talk to each other about and complain about is like their voice and how it holds up on tour. So I always ask people, you know, over your career, did you have many problems with your voice? Cause it seemed like when you were up there on stage, you were giving it harder than just about anybody. And I mean, you weren't screaming necessarily, but you were really pushing your voice like to its max.
Yeah. I did have problems off and on, you know, during Never Take Friendship Personal, right before we started recording that, my aunt actually lives in Kelowna, Canada, and she gives lessons. Her name's Sandra Babel. And I went up there and kind of worked with her. And because at that point, I kept perpetually losing my voice. And what she said was, you know, golfers don't put in 100% of their swing. They put in 75%. And in the same way as a golf, as like a professional golfer, you need to like hold something back. And if that just means hold something back for the next night, then that's what you got to do.
That makes sense. You know, I've never heard it put that quite that way, but that is quite eloquent.
I think so. And you come to learn your voice. You know, I toured with one vocalist, and he would have to warm up for like over an hour and use vapor machines and all this stuff and eat a certain diet. And you know what? And it worked for him. And for me, you know, for me, it was about a 15-minute warm-up, knowing I shouldn't have anything milk-related. You know, if I want to sing the best I possibly can, don't drink milk or anything, any dairy products, and then make sure that I get a solid 15 minutes in. But to me, I always love to push my voice because I feel like, you know, I can sing like regular, you know, I can sing or I can put passion behind it, put a little grovel behind it, you know, like just, you know, I feel like kind of the strain. And I even love when vocalists crack, you know, because to me it shows like, you're pushing, you're going for it. And so I enjoyed that. And I kind of wanted to emanate that on stage, to be able to not like prove to anybody that was giving my all, but literally giving my all, you know?
Well, yeah. But I mean, that's the thing about singing. It's people misunderstand what singing is. And, you know, at least 50%, I'm going to say it's probably more like 80%, is really the character that you're putting into it.
You know, I totally agree.
Sorry, I heard some crackling on the line. I don't know what that was. And really though, like it's at least 50 to 80%, I'm going to say, is that character and that, and you get that from pushing your voice and going into those sometimes unpleasant feelings.
Yeah.
And I sometimes feel like if I'm not in pain up there on stage, maybe I'm doing it wrong. You know, I feel like I need to be in pain and I'm singing about something painful. And it's like those things, just those feelings kind of should be coordinated in a way. Do you feel that way too?
Well, I mean, I do believe, you know, several things you said, but I do believe I like character and voices. I've always loved that, you know, from Jeff Buckley to Morrissey to Nico. Those are my favorite singers because I love that, like that texture. And I do believe, you know, that you have to believe the lyrics you write. You know, you really have to grasp onto those. So if, you know, and I think that shines through. If you really believe what you're singing up there, if you really, those words really meant that much to you when you wrote them, I think it'll come through. And I also know you can tell when people are phoning it in. I mean, people, this audience have a sense of that. They know when you're phoning it in. So, you know, if you're not up there, like 100%, you know, believing in what you're singing, what you're stating, I think people could tell.
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about Anne Berlin and kind of your crazy career that you had. Because it is not, I mean, you guys are a very unique band in everything that had happened to you guys. And I remember the first time we met, do you remember we were at Furnace Fest?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Alabama.
Yep.
Only time we ever played Alabama, actually. I'm sure you guys, being a Christian band, probably rolled through Alabama a few times after that. But we played it once with you guys at Furnace Fest. I remember meeting you. And, you know, that was 2003, I want to say. And, you know, we were both on our first albums. And, you know, obviously both our bands have had, you know, careers, and my band is still going, and you guys just broke up last year. But I want to talk about how you guys started on Tooth and Nail, and then you ended up being this major label radio band. And I guess, like, if you could start from the beginning of how, like, you guys came with Tooth and Nail and how that progressed to that next step, I would love to hear that story.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, so we played a lot of shows early on with a punk rock band, and we were kind of like, you know, got to a point where punk rock was just not our thing anymore. We didn't, you know, we could listen to it. We enjoyed it. 7 Seconds and Face to Face, A Veil, and all that kind of stuff. Hot Water Music was a huge influence. But we just,
that's Florida band, so it makes sense.
But we just got to a point where we just kind of like, this is, you know, we like this music, but we just don't want to play it. And so from there, we kind of like spawned a side project, if you will, Anne Berlin, and our punk rock band was actually funding Anne Berlin to go and record these demos. So we went to Atlanta, Georgia, and did 5-song demo with a guy named Matt Goldman there. And Matt Goldman was like, wow, you guys really have something here. Can I share these with my Warner Brother friends? And I was like, sure, of course you can. So you know, during awesome. During that time, we, you know, because he called Warner Brothers and somebody called somebody, and you know, it kind of got around. We had, you know, back when MP3.com was a thing.
Oh, I loved MP3.com.
So we had accumulated 25,000 plays in 3 months, which at that time was like crazy. You know, that's.
I remember it was. I remember MP3.com. I remember Rufio was like the big MP3.com band.
Yep. Yes, they were.
You guys were one of them too.
You know, I mean, I don't want to say we were a big MP3 band, but for a brand new band coming out of the gate, hitting 25,000 in 3 months was just something that the labels were like, well, somebody's listening. You know, somebody's like really catching on to these songs. And so then the demos, you know, that was Ready Fuels, were kind of our first bigger song, I guess, our first notable song anyway. That kind of spawned a lot of talk within labels. And Tooth & Nail kind of sent one of their guys out, Chad Johnson. Well, because of the punk rock band, because of the Central Florida theme, we were touring a lot with Under Oath and you know, bands like Ludacris, which is now Norma Jean.
Yeah, yeah. I booked Ludacris once for a show up in Canada.
That's awesome.
And they had to change their name rather quickly.
Rather quickly, yeah, absolutely. So here comes this guy, this A&R, and he came down to watch the show, and it went Under Oath opened the show, then we were second, and then Norma Jean closed the show because they were Atlanta locals and Georgia locals anyway. And so they closed. Well, can you imagine kind of like an Amberlin? We're, I don't want to call us pop rock, but we were like rock with a lot of pop influence, especially early on. So of course the show is going to go bad, regardless if you played flawless, because you got Under Oath of the crowd, and it's a sold out show.
Especially back then, like Under Oath was like more like a grindcore band in the early days, you know.
With Dallas was still singing, you know, and so it was insane. The crowd was insane for Under Oath. Then we go up, and of course we flopped. Everybody was just staring at us, and then here comes Norma Jean, and the crowd was insane. And the night wasn't flawless. We were all nervous as crap because, you know, we knew that A&Rs were in the audience. So the A&R called Brandon and was like, do not sign them. Please don't sign them. They were horrible. And Brandon was like, you know what? Forget it. I'm just going to take a chance on them. Just sign them. And that was how it all began. And we flew up to Seattle to record with Aaron Sprinkle in end of 2002 and put out the record up.
Had he done the Pedro the Lion record yet at that point?
Had he done the Pedro? I'm not sure.
Yeah, the Control
no,
record.
No, I don't know.
One of my favorite albums. I every time I hear his name, Aaron Sprinkle's name, I'm like, oh, that record.
Yeah.
How is working with him? Is he, because I mean, some of his records are like magical.
Yeah.
And I wonder how he is working as like a dude.
You know, in the early days, I was so full of like piss and vinegar and so hungry. You know, I was, you know, I've never seen my equivalent to who I was in those days as far as like getting things done. You know, like I was doing it all. Hustling, you know, again, just like we talked about earlier, I was the hustler and I was on fire. So Aaron and I didn't get along. We got along during Blueprints. We didn't really get along during Never Take Friendship Personal. I couldn't stand the dude. And then Cities, we were back good, but I knew in the back of my head, like, oh man, he had done so many records. He was accustomed to the stress and the strain of a record, but I wasn't. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he wanted to explore, like, let's work on this for an hour. And then, you know what, we'll take a couple of hours off and then we'll come back to it. And then tonight we'll jump on it. But I want to, you know, go, do, you know, I wanted to pull like 13, 14, 15 hours in the studio. And this dude was like, hey, I've got a family and hey, which is fair.
Sure. Of course it's, I mean, I'm sure you understand that more now.
Now I look back and was like, dude, I just didn't know. I just didn't understand, you know, but at the time, you know, I just was so amped to work and work hard, long hour days, that I didn't understand that there was life outside of being in a band. And obviously now I do, because we went back and we did Vital with him. And then, you know, I got to choose whoever I wanted to produce my vocals. I could have chosen anybody. Everybody got to choose who they did guitars with, who they did with drums with.
Yeah.
And I chose Aaron because I love the dude. We understand. We comprehend each other. I've never worked faster with a producer. I mean, there was one song I did Dissenter in about 15 minutes off Lowborn. In 15 minutes, just because, like, I knew him. We knew each other. He knew what to tell me. We were at that point, he was almost like another member of the band. He knew what I was going for. I knew what he was going for. He just had to say a few words, and 15 minutes later, the entire song was done.
That's an amazing thing, and I love that you bring that up, because I've interviewed a bunch of singers and I haven't really gotten into that. I've talked to some people about producers and everyone's like, yeah, no, he is cool. But there's that relationship, like when you're in the studio working, usually it's more in the evening time, right? Because you do guitars in the morning or whatever. And I love working with a producer, like one-on-one, no one else in the room. And like, you just know, like you do a take, and it's like, you didn't get there. He knows you didn't get there. There's no conversation about the take. There's no like, oh, we have to listen to it. It's just like, you do it again, And when you have that kind of like, it's almost like when you're playing basketball and you watch Pippen and Jordan play together. And it's like those guys can't even describe what it is. But you need to have that with a producer. Yeah. And that, I guess that's what you had with Aaron.
Oh, I do. And I still do. I love that guy. And if there's ever a chance to work with him again, I would jump on it because he's just incredible.
So you guys are on Tooth and Nail. You guys have, a very, very solid career. Putting out Never Take Friendship Personal is like, a classic record. You guys end up on Universal Republic. How did that all happen? Do you guys finish your contract with Tooth and Nail?
We had signed for three records initially, but after Never Take Friendship Personal, we had at least three to four major record labels just, coming after us. But Tooth and Nail at that time was kind of in transition to EMI, and they just wanted too much money. To buy us out of our contract was going to cost too much money for the major label. So everybody said, listen, we'll get back to you. Tooth and Nail is just not, this isn't, yep. We really want cities. We want that, but we just, it's not the right timing because we don't want to put you in massive, massive debt out of the gate.
Sure.
And so we felt like that was fair, but all of us in the back of our head knew, and I had a great conversation. It was me, Brandon, and my manager, Kyle. And we sat down with Brandon and we said, Brandon, here's really what we want. And it had nothing to do with money at all. I can promise you it had nothing to do with money. But here's the two stipulations we want. We want to be on the radio and we want to hit international hard. And he said, man, at this time, I can't promise you that. And we were like, thank you, Brandon. And I was like, with your blessing, I think we're going to move on. And there was no ill will. I mean, obviously Brandon wanted to keep us on, he offered us a contract, but that's what we really wanted. We wanted to go after radio. We knew that we had we felt like Paper Thin Him, even though it got to like number 32 on the alternative charts, we felt like it could have had bigger legs if we would have had a bigger production,
So why did you feel radio was so important?
Because we had reached a glass ceiling. If you look at the history of all Tooth and Nail bands, no one in the history of Tooth and Nail, all those amazing bands, no one has ever done better outside of Tooth and Nail. I don't care what band you were, you've never done better. And we felt like we have hit the glass ceiling and we've reached the pinnacle of our fans. We've reached we've hit the same markets we've hit. We've done that. We've toured with the same bands over and over. We need more. And that's, I think that's any, I don't care if you're a company, if you're selling computers, if you're selling artwork, I don't care what you are in your medium and your format, whatever your business is, and not that we viewed Amberlin as a business, but that I viewed it as an art, and our medium had hit a glass ceiling and the only other place to go was radio, we didn't want to, we didn't want to completely change our sound. We didn't want to I don't know what else you would do. I mean, we were kind of backed into a corner of, hey, we have reached the pinnacle of what we can do here at Tooth and Nail, because, and cities had done it. You couldn't have gotten bigger on Tooth and Nail with cities. Sure. For us, I'm not saying as any band, I'm saying for us personally.
No, I mean, it was the same thing with Victory Records. We were on Victory Records. I mean, they had, when we started on there, they had three radio guys. They had three radio guys and they couldn't get anything on the radio. But that's how important radio was for selling albums at that point.
Right, yeah.
That they had three full-time staff just attempting it in hopes that something would stick, because that's how big radio was. And I mean, of course, I really want to talk about the transition to Universal Republic, but like it's probably kind of funny now because now it's like I don't even know if radio sells records anymore or if records even sell.
Yeah.
You know, when you finally get your song on the radio and it's like, well, no one's even buying records anymore.
Yeah, it's true.
But go back to the transition back to Universal Republic, because that's
so the final decision was made on. Well, a couple weeks ago, my friend, he was making fun of me because he was just like, you know, calling me rich because I have a Land Rover and he has an Acura SUV. And he was like, you know, just making fun of me like, oh, dude, like, you know, Richie Rich over here. And I was like, dude, that's life. Life is all about a perception. I was like, how much did your Acura cost? And he was like, well, I just bought it. It was $14,000. I was like, great. And I pulled up Craigslist and I showed him. I was like, here's my Land Rover. The reason I bought a Land Rover is because for me, I have two kids and I want them as safe as possible. But here's the Craigslist ad. I bought my Land Rover for $7,500. So the perception in life is if you see a Land Rover, it was expensive. It's, you know?
Yeah.
And so well, in the same way deals with human...
Ask me, I drive a BMW 3 Series too. And people say the same things to me. Oh yeah, you're the big rock singer. You know, drive a black BMW. And then I say, oh, what's your car? And it's like, oh, I got like a Honda Pilot. I'm like, that car is, and my car's a 2008. You know, your car's a 2012. It's worth way more than my car. You want to trade?
Yeah. So, yeah,
you know, but you're right. The perception thing is real.
Life is about perceptions. And so the fact of the matter is for the average person, when you say Universal Republic or you say major label record, the perception of the band changes in people's minds. They feel like you're massive for whatever reason, even though it doesn't mean you're massive. It, you know, your contract could be, you know, we probably could have got a far better contract as far as points were concerned and, you know, and contracts were concerned and all these, you know, little nuances if we would have stayed with Tooth and Nail. But we knew that the perception in people's minds for a major label was much bigger. And also, and case in point, We had submitted for Warped Tour time and time and time again and got turned down. But when Warped Tour heard that we were on a major label, that was the summer we got Warped Tour. How crazy is that? We got into a Land Rover.
It makes total sense.
We got into a Land Rover and suddenly we were the pretty girl on the block. And so
but, I love that analogy.
Yeah, so it's funny, but you know, and here we are. And so but we signed to them because they said, here's what we can do for you, man. We are going to get you to international markets. We're going to push your record to international markets. We're going to get you on tour and we're going to get you on the radio and we will fight for radio. And they were right. And they did, man. We did. We had three songs that had broke the top five, one that went number one. And they were right. And we chose correctly, the major label. And again, perception, we started to get tours that we never got. We never would have had the opportunity to. We were out with obviously 30 Seconds and, you know, Linkin Park and Smashing Pumpkins and, you know, all these bands just suddenly like, you know, obviously through the radio and through the major label and through the opportunities that radio opened up to us, we were suddenly to a new elevated game and the only band that has ever been more successful outside of Tooth and Nail than On.
Right. Well, that number one song, you're talking about Feel Good Drag, right?
Yep.
And that song was such an interesting story because when it became a hit on the radio, I was like, I know this fucking song. And like, you know, this is like, I know this is an old song.
Yeah.
So, and like, I mean, the one I think about, the classic is, you mentioned earlier that you were a fan of Face to Face and you know, on their first record, they had a song Disconnected.
Oh, I love Disconnected.
And then, right, it's a great song.
I remember the intro to that song. It said, "No way, we will never put this song on a record again. We're not going to sell out like that." Yeah. And then 1, 2, 3, 4.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Because it was on an earlier record, and then the same thing happened. They were on A&M or something, and then they ended up putting Disconnected on with it was Disconnected, and then like a Descendants cover, I think, were the two bonus tracks on the record, and when I heard that and I knew, you know, I knew it was like, and I mean that song, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't even think it was a single.
No, it wasn't.
No. And it was like a deep cut. It was like
number
probably
nine.
Like in the on the B side, on the side B. So when I heard that song, I said, okay, somebody from the label must've heard that song and was like, I need that one. That's a hit. and kind of forced you to re-record it. Is that what happened?
Not at all.
Oh no. Okay.
It was me. I said, listen, I mean, I basically laid out, hey, you know, it was the band all discussed, like, hey, I never felt like that song got a fair chance. What you said, it was number 9 on a record that at that time, it might have been like a favorite amongst the, you know, quote unquote, the scene or the, you know, the culture or the, you know, the P.
I'll admit it was one of my favorite songs.
That's
from that
awesome.
Record, for sure.
Yeah, but, you know, we had just started playing it live and we fell in love with the song. We played it live for the first time in Australia and the crowd loved it. We were like, really? This song never gets requested. It never gets talked about. But see, that was that song. It wasn't even supposed to be on Never Take Friendship Personal. I flew back in and recorded those vocals with a guy named Zach, who was Aaron Sprinkle's assistant, because we ran out of time. And so I didn't feel like it got a fair shake all the way around from my vocal standpoint, you know, kind of like slapping on the record. I felt like it was slapped on the record at the last moment.
Was there red tape? Was there red tape getting that back from Tooth and Nail?
Oh, since it was course, on, like, man. You know, like.
So how did that work out?
Well, we basically believed in the song so much that we said that we will make. You know, we did not make 1 cent on any publishing on that song. Our biggest song.
Oh my God.
And we didn't make a writer's cut or a publishing cut on any of those because we had to. We had to say, listen, Tooth and Nail, we believe in this song so much, you know, we'll give you our share of the profits. And that's how much we believed in it. And we took a massive gamble. We took a massive gamble by putting it on the record. We put a massive gamble on making that our first single. But we believed in it, and you know,
and you were and right.
We were right.
You were right.
And, you know, somebody today wrote me and said, "Do you feel like, you know, the popularity of that song, of Feel Good Drag, overshadowed all the new music that you've put out since?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely, it did overshadow. But it's a catch-22 because I would not have been able to create new music had it not been for that song for Feel Good Drag." And people gave us a little bit of flack for it, but it was hilarious to me. It was just the most hilarious thing because, like, the song went number one. And the reason that you guys voted for it or got number one is because our fans rallied around it. So you're sitting there, you know, punching yourself and saying, why would they record it? And then the other, with that same hand, you're like calling the radio station and requesting it. So thank you. You know, like,
it is hilarious.
Funny, but when it got popular, people got like all like, oh no. And I was just like, dude, this is no such thing as a sellout because I did not make a single cent. You could ask any label, you could ask my manager, lawyer, if I made a single cent on any publishing on that, because we didn't. It wasn't about us, and never ever did the record label come and say, hey, you know that song Feel Good Drag? We want you to re-record it. It was never. We approached the label. We approached our producer. The label didn't even know we were going to do it. We brought it up with Neil Avron and said, what do you think about doing this song, re-recording it? And our producer, Neil Avron, was like, yeah, I love that song. If you guys want to do it, redo it, let's do it. So awesome. Never once was a label involved at all.
Awesome. That is awesome. Well, I mean, I guess the transition from indie, you know, indie Christian label, you know, where you have a lot of Christian fans, obviously with Tooth and Nail being a Christian label, I mean, I know they were not every band ever on the label was Christian, but for the most part they were, and going to totally like a mainstream label, like Universal Republic. How hard was that for you guys? Like, all of a sudden your fans are not your fans anymore. They're completely different people. Was that difficult for you?
Not at all, man. I mean, as musicians, like, I don't care your age, race, color, creed, religion. As a musician or as an artist, I don't care if you're a painter or a dancer or whatever your medium is, your format, don't you want to expose it to the maximum amount of people for the maximum amount of joy? Like, and if people don't like it, just turn it off or don't go to the art gallery. Just as simple as that, you know, never.
Right. But I guess part of it too, though, is like you have your diehard fans that are like buying your entire, you know, they're buying into your whole band. They're buying into, you know, your albums and your multiple albums, and they're going to your shows and they're buying all your merch. And now you're on a label where you're getting one song pushed onto the radio. People are coming out to see your shows, and some people are really only know like your one song.
Yeah. Yeah. That was different.
I guess that thing must, like, that was real. I'm sure that's real.
Oh, that's totally real. Oh, and, yeah.
And I want to know how that made you feel, because that for me, I think that would be hard.
It is hard. It was totally hard. I mean, But where am I losing in that though? You know, like, it was weird because I knew that I invested so much in time and effort and energy in the studio in those 9 other songs on the record that you weren't really paying attention to. Like, and yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
But you're at my show. You're being exposed to new music, to the opening bands and the.
But the fear is, and I keep interrupting you, I'm sorry. But the fear is that you're going to get these fans and they're going to be like, oh, I love that song. They're going to come to your show. They're going to buy a shirt, whatever, maybe they aren't. And you're going to be playing like this huge, you know, huge room, and you're going to have this growth, and your existing fans that loved your 3 previous records are all going to be like, well, I don't like this band anymore because these other people coming out, they aren't on the same level as me. And I know in a way you're going to be like, well, I don't care. Then they aren't real fans. But there is a certain, like, I found them first. And there are bands whose careers have fallen off based on that.
Yeah.
You know, based on getting mainstream success.
Yeah, I can see that. But I think that, you know, the fact of the matter is this wasn't our first record. This was our 4th record that was that successful. So the fact of the matter is we had been grinding it out, man. I mean, grinding it out. You know how it is. You know, playing shows to 60 people, 40 people, 20 people, you know, I just the most insane, you know, the biggest shows, you know, even the smallest shows. And so the fact of the matter is those people knew us, you know, the people that were there, they knew that we weren't trying to like pull one over them or become the massive band. Like we were putting it out. We were putting in 100% on Never Take Friendship Personal, and we were taking, you know, giving 100% on New Surrender. You know, there was no difference. They weren't looking on stage at like, I'm not suddenly wearing a pink boa and, you know, cock rocket it and not talking to them. I'm not putting on like studs and not wearing a shirt on stage and thinking I'm better. I'm spitting on them and, you know, what's up, mother? Yeah. You know, I'm not doing that. They see the same 5 dudes, sweaty, pouring it out, just laying it all on the line. And I think that I think at the end of the night, it's a little forgivable to look around and be like, dude, who's that guy? I've never seen him at this show. When you look on stage and hopefully you're in the front row and the same dude's like waving at you and calling you out like, hey man, what's up? Good to see you again. You know, I didn't change my verbatim. I didn't get up there and start like, spouting off something like "Hello, Cleveland," and kind of making this ambiguous talk. I was, you know, you could have watched a show in 2004, watched me in 2009, and I guarantee I was most likely the same. Sure, my pants got a little looser, but you know that's about it. I'm not like wearing girl jeans anymore, but I'm definitely. There's probably some pictures where I'm wearing the same exact t-shirt, man. People make fun of me all the time, but I'm like, dude, I love this shirt. It's my show shirt.
I'm the same dude. Yeah. I'm my show shirt.
The same show shirt, man. I didn't have, Universal didn't come to us and be like, okay, man, I need you guys to all wear black because that's what we were doing. Did, I need you to wear a jacket. It's like, dude, I did that back in the day.
But did Universal come to you and say, we need this kind of song? Because once you strike gold at radio, there's obviously got to be some kind of pressure.
No, I mean, there's internal pressure. There's massive internal pressure. Oh, well, there was pressure before we even got, you know, we got signed onto a major label. Everything ups your game, man. Yeah, I had an A&R call me before we went into New Surrender and say, hey, listen, man, if this record fails, it's all on you. You're the one to blame. We're not going to blame anybody else. And I went a little nuts, man. I went a little crazy because, I mean, that was a hard season. But it's a pressure from the fans. It's a pressure from the rest of the guys in the band. It's a label. It's myself. I mean, dude, Cities, you know, was a monumental album in our career. How do you outdo Cities? You know, so I had that pressure. I had a pressure of success, of being even more successful, you know? So I don't know. It was nuts, man. But never once was the label like, you need to sound like Maroon 5. We're letting you know. You need to cut your hair like this band. You need to do this. Because they signed Amber Lynn. Now, if we had been a new band and this was our first record, I'm positive that happens all the time. Hey, you need to sound like this.
So they never said, we need this kind of song, or no, they never said this is, you know, change these lyrics.
No, dude.
You were able to have creative control, where you were able to go in with Neil Avron or whoever and just be like, this is the record, and then you sent it to the label. They never interjected?
Dude, I had more times I've had more experiences of people telling me to change my lyrics on Tooth and Nail than I ever had on Universal. I bet Universal would be stoked if I started cussing on a record or something. They'd be like, yeah, that's edgy. Wow, that's so cool. No, never, not once did they come and say, you know, they signed us to be Amberlynn. He knew exactly what he was getting into. And if anything, he wanted me to keep, you know, continuing the Amberlynn, just be Amberlynn and to a bigger audience, you know.
Cool. Well, hey, that's a great, I mean, wow, that's so much insight to your career and that, how that all happened. But you're not done singing. You still have your solo project, Anchor in Braille.
Yeah, it's coming out early. Nobody knows this yet, but it looks like it's coming out January 2016.
Beautiful.
On my old friend's Tooth and Nail.
Tooth and Nail, still there.
Nobody knows that either. So there you go, two for two.
Cool. And what are your plans for the release? Are you going to go back on the road?
Well, I'm going to see. You know, I really want to. I really love this record. I love touring with Anchor in Braille, man. It was just, you know, I played a show in Washington, D.C. at this Rock and Roll Hotel, and that was by far top five favorite shows all time. We played with Civil Twilight. It was me and Micah Talks and a guy named Kevin that was in Civil Twilight. Some good friends on bass and drums. So it was such a great experience, man. I would love it. It just kind of has to work out in parameter of time. And I also want to be able to tour. I like to tour smarter, not harder now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, after the initial conversation about last year, I can understand why.
Yeah, man, I'm all into it.
Do you feel like when you're doing that band, you know, Anchor in Braille, when you're doing your solo, you know, stuff, does it feel more like you? When you're on stage, like personality wise?
Oh yeah, it does feel like me. It really does. I mean, it feels like, you know, I'm a very unconfident individual. I enjoy kind of being the background. I think my least favorite part of being in a band was any type of notoriety or fame or, press or, you know, to me, it was just kind of, I don't like that. I kind of like being that guy in the shadows and, being a little more.
So you're kind of an introvert.
I am an introvert, but I mean, I did not want to be that for Amberlynn. I did not want, that was not the character that I chose in Amberlynn. And so, yeah, I enjoy performing with Anchor, bro. It's a lot of fun. It's very freeing, but I'm not saying it's better than Amberlynn. I'm just saying it's different. You know, that's a big difference. I loved, you know, writing and all that stuff for Amberlynn. But for me, Anchor in Braille was just different. It was just a different expression, a different side. All my Anchor in Braille records are something, even this one's going to be much different than any of the other Anchor in Braille records because it's usually tends to go what I'm listening to. And so I'm listening to a lot of like Washed Out and Frank Ocean. And that's what this Anchor in Braille record is, Washed Out and Frank Ocean.
Okay, there you go. There you go. Well, you mentioned your personality in Amberlynn, like that you've almost say like you it was like a put on thing because you're an introverted dude and you have to be like an extroverted, you know, rock singer, like entertainer in Amberlynn. Is that something you ever struggle with now that Amberlynn's done? Do you ever like find yourself being like, wait, am I being Steven Christian, you know, frontman of major label band Amberlynn with the number one radio single, or am I just being straight Steven Christian, like the dude, or, you know, or the, you know, working, you know, in a church in Albuquerque? Like, is that ever a struggle with your kind of post professional music career?
It's different, you know, like expectations, you know, again, it's perception. Like, what do people want? What do people want from me? You know? And I think that's another reason, like why I don't feel like I have that many close friends. I have very few, and not because it's always, I'm so guarded now. You know, a lot of my friends are musicians because it's kind of like, oh, okay, you get it. You get where I'm from. You get what these struggles are as a singer. And so you get it. You understand. It's weird, you know, because for a long time there, you know, starting right after Blueprints, people started to want to be my friend and people wanted things from me. Hence, Never Take Friendship Personal, the title of the record.
So from there, you
started to guard myself like, oh my gosh, what are you? Who are you? What do you want from me? And that kind of put barriers up. Man, maybe I could have had some great, great friends now if I had just like, if I had just kind of gone naively into trusting everyone at every situation. But I just kind of like saw people getting screwed over, and I was just kind of like, man, I really don't want that for myself. And so I kind of began to be guarded. But I don't know, people's perception, what do people want? And I kind of try to tend to, you know, reach out. And you know, if somebody walks up to me and is just like, hey, I'm Stephen Christian, I would never, it's not a front, it's not a cocky front. It's just kind of a front of like, hey, man, it's good to meet you. Good to see you. Like, hey, you know, and kind of making sure that they're taken care of, because I would hate for somebody to walk away and be like, dude, that guy's a prick. You know, it's, I don't mm-hmm. want that, you know? But again, you know, I don't know. It's different. It's different to put on different faces, you know, because with Amberlynn going out to the crowd, it's like I kind of had to put on a show. I wanted to put it all out there. I wanted to give them everything that they want and that they felt, I felt like they needed. And so I remember seeing live videos of Mick Jagger and how he, dude, if he said, I want everybody to quack like a duck and do jumping jacks, oh my gosh, he had them in the palm of their hand. And so I wanted to like, you know, that wasn't me. I couldn't do that. Like,
it's interesting because I'm like, I don't feel any different when I'm talking to you now, when I'm talking to my girlfriend, when I'm hanging out with my parents, when I'm hanging out with my nephews, than when I do on stage, backstage, talking
That's
to kids
awesome,
at the
man.
Merch. I don't That's feel awesome. Differently. Obviously, there's times when I'm in like a bit of a different mood, but I don't ever feel like I'm putting on like any kind of a show, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess that is awesome. I don't really think about it. So when I hear you kind of saying, oh, I have this personality and now I have a different personality with Anchor and Braille, and I have a different, I mean, I guess I have a different personality when I live my life.
Yeah.
All that is like super cool. And
I think you need to be like, I mean, you'd have to like sit in with my psychologist, you know, back in the day, because I mean, you gotta understand that like I grew up and I lived in 12 different places by the time I was 12 years old. I never had friends. I never had like a stable environment growing up. And so even my, you know, I was that kid in school that wore all black, like I, you know, and kind of kept my head down and wore like, you know, like punk rock t-shirts. Nobody really talked to me. Like I would be shocked if anybody from my high school knew who I was afterwards, you know, because my high school yearbook, literally I was kind of like, you know, I just want to sign the people I know. And my high school yearbook right this second has six people's signatures. And, you know, because I wasn't popular, I wasn't a friend. I wasn't, you know, because I didn't know if I was going to move again. If I didn't know if I was going to be uprooted and leave. So I stayed to myself. And so that kind of, those seeds of kind of moving around as a young and coming from an unstable home planted insecurities and kind of unconfidence. I didn't have confidence to walk up and like, you know, walk up to people like, what's up, man? I'm Steven. Let's hang. You know, it wasn't like that. It was like, dude, I'm going to sit in the back of the class, wear all black, you know, scribble Metallica lyrics on my folder and not really talk to you. You know, that was my personality. So coming into a band, I'm not going to stand on stage, look, stare at the floor, wear all black and kind of like mumble in between songs. I want to get up there and present the person and who I feel like the music should belong to. And I actually love the person that I developed, you know, because now, you know, later on in leadership roles in different ways and different areas, and even at the church, I've developed this confidence, and it was a learned confidence. It wasn't a natural confidence. It wasn't something that I had was innate or genetic. It was a premeditated kind of something that I worked on. Like other people would go to school for this, I went to Amberlynn, you know, I developed it over the years. Even if you watched a 2002 or 2003 video of Amberlynn, I was standing behind a microphone stand the entire show, 100%. So, you know, yeah, it was just, it's just, you know, anyway, I hate to get all like going into depth, but it was something that, you know, was learned. And some people can be like, dude, are you putting on a show? Is that not real? No, it's really who I just, you know, really who I wanted to be. I really aspired to that. Now I don't know where the character of Amberlynn that I developed and myself, I don't know where one begins and one ends, you know? So when I do meet someone, though, I have like, oh, they're coming at me and I can see the look in their eyes. I know they know me from Amberlynn. I may have kind of like my own nuances or a different kind of set, whereas opposed to if you're an, you know, an older person and you're coming up to the church and you're meeting me, I know that you don't know Amberlynn, we might like talk differently, but I'm still the same person. So it is the reality for me.
But there is something about being a lead singer and having that, you know, command of a crowd, and you do it for so long. There's that is a learned skill. I'm not going to say like, I already said the whole thing about how I'm the same dude, you know, in all facets of my life, but obviously you get more comfortable with talking in front of a crowd, you get, you know, performing and all that. And that does, you know, make you sort of somewhat of a leader in a way in society, you know, like for example, like if you're at a movie theater and someone's talking, I'm going to say that you or me are probably going to be the first person to say something. Because whatever it is, that personality that you sort of acquire by doing what we do, it's a real thing.
I totally agree, man.
So I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I do want to ask you about your podcast, which is coming out very shortly. Tell the people about it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of it, that's my 2-year-old daughter in the background yelling at me, and I love it. Hey, what's up,
buddy? I love it too.
So it's a podcast basically called The Art Collective. And I always drew my inspiration from life itself, like everything, like much like I'm sure you do, like friends, family, you know, relationships, but beyond that, like books, movies, you know, theater, other musicians, other artists. And so the objective of the podcast is to really talk about musicians, about the influences, namely books, like authors, and then vice versa, you know, get a hold of authors and say, man, what books inspired you to write what, are you listening to some music right now? I mean, what music are you listening to? Did any of that give you any kind of sense of direction or kind of a theme for your book? So, you know, yeah, it was really cool, man. I I've always listened to podcasts from Radiolab to, you know, Freakonomics to This American Life. I love it all. And so I just want to set out and I'm going to just try it myself. It seems a lot of fun. And
I'm new to podcasting too. And I wanted to ask you how it is kind of being on the other side of the microphone. Is that like a bit hard for you to interview people when you're used to being interviewed for so many years?
It is, man. I'm so bad at it.
Hope I'm not that bad at it, but I'm trying my best.
No, you're crushing it, man. I'm just kind of, cause you know, I want to dig deeper and I want to, go further, but I don't know how to you'll see. So hopefully I get better as the podcast go on. But right now I'm just like, what is your favorite color?
Well, I think it's a great podcast idea. And I got to admit, every book I read, pretty much I get to some point in the book when I'm just like, where does this person come up with these ideas? Like, where does this come from? This is genius.
Yep,
you know?
I agree.
And that's something that I don't think a lot of people really ever tap into. I can't really remember reading a lot of interviews with authors before and to kind of see what makes them tick. So that's a very, very cool thing you're doing.
Awesome, man. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. You're really good at this.
What's the podcast called so people can check it out after they listen to this one?
It is called The Art Collective.
Beautiful.
The Art Collective. Yep. That's it, man. You can find us online Hey, what are you saying, baby? You want to say something?
Yeah. Bring her on.
Yeah. Hey, what do you want to say? Come here. Oh, there is a lizard. Oh, and it's dead. Baby, don't touch. Yeah, that's a dead lizard. Yep. Come on.
Oh, in the desert.
Back.
Yeah.
He's yeah. There's a. He's sleeping. She said she. Yes, baby. Hey, he's sleeping, honey. Shh.
Just sleeping. Go, it's okay.
That's awesome. Oh, man. That's hilarious. Anyway.
All right, Stephen. I'll let you get back to your family.
Yeah, man.
Great talking to you. Good luck with the new Anchor and Braille record in January. Everyone, make sure you listen to that. And hope to see you around.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for your time.
All right. Peace and love. Take care.
Yes, sir. Bye.
And there it is. My interview with Stephen Christian. The way he opened up was so incredible. Just amazing. Thank you again for tuning in. Remember, every Monday we'll have a new episode of this. Next week's going to be awesome again. And please check out Twitter, check out Facebook, Instagram. We're on there. Please check out leadsingersyndrome.com. And as is Lead Singer Syndrome podcast tradition,
I'm going to leave you with a tune. This is the former number one radio track, Amberlynn's The Feel Good Drag. Enjoy. Have a great week.
Send your trap, I seem to invite. Tell me, darling, where do we begin?